My castaway this week is a superstar of the small screen. She has always been famous, chosen as a starlet by the Rank Film Organisation in the 50s. She went on to Hollywood, where in a succession of seductive and voluptuous roles, she worked alongside actors such as Gregory Peck, Jack Hawkins and Richard Burton. And then 7 years ago, she was cast as the arch-villainess of soap, Alexis Carrington in Dynasty, a role which has brought her worldwide fame. She says she's a born survivor, and indeed, Alexis may or may not be dead, but Joan Collins goes on. How is life after Alexis, Joan? Do you miss her?
I don't miss those early morning calls, I must say, but it's like a person who is a sort of long-lost cousin or something. You sort of miss her when you think about it, but you don't when she's not around.
Has it also meant an end to all that travelling backwards and forwards across the Atlantic, or are you still doing that?
Well, I do have a slight touch of travel mania. I'm a born gypsy, and I've always been told that I must have lived in 40 or 50 different houses and flats. And I always make wherever I am a sort of home, kind of the nesting instinct, even if it's only a motel room for one night or a suite at a hotel for three or four. I bring my own things. I have lots of books and photographs and records, obviously.
And you unpack everything and put it all away in the drawers, even if you're only staying for the night, do you?
Not quite. I hate unpacking and packing. I usually get somebody to do it. You see, it's quite terrible.
So what sort of home are you going to make on the desert island, do you think?
Well, since I'm absolutely hopeless with my hands, I have a feeling I won't survive for very long until some sort of Robinson Crusoe type comes along to rescue me.
Are you not practical at all? You must be.
No, I'm not practical at all in that kind of way. I'm practical much more with my mind, but I'm completely hopeless. I do not belong in the electronic society. I can't even work an oven because I find it all terribly complicated. And those signals that things have on are meaningless.
Things that flash at.
Yeah. So actually I probably would do better on a desert island because it's just simplicity.
But could you hunt and could you kill?
No, I don't think I could kill. And I couldn't hunt, but I could. I wouldn't care about eating meat and fish because I would climb a tree and get some berries or open a coconut. And since I prefer that kind of food, I don't eat meat very much anyway. I would probably try and catch a fish, but since I'm allergic to shellfish, I have to stay away from crab and lobster.
And the music, how important would that be to help you?
Oh, terribly important. I mean, I would probably have it on all the time. Although I would love to listen to the sound of the sea. But when I wasn't listening to that, I would play one of my wonderful 8 records.
So what's the first one?
I'd like to hear one of those wonderful Neapolitan songs that Luciano Pavarotti sings, maybe Torna Sorrento, which I love, because I think it's the sort of thing you could stand on a beach and the sound would just fill you with joy. Ideo mare quanto è bello, spira tanto sentimento, come tu a chi tiene a me te, che scettato mai è sonna. Guarda qua che stuccia radio, senti si e si sciurrarà. No profumo a così fino tinto core se va e tu dici o parto addio allontana la stucore da sta terra
Torna a Sorrento, sung by Luciano Pavarotti with the National Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Giancarlo Chiaramello. What did you want to be when you were little?
Well, when I was little, I had a bunch of things I wanted to be. I was quite addicted to a programme on television called Dick Barton's Special Agent, and I decided I had to be a detective and perhaps get on Dick's team with Jock and Snowy. And I got a detective kit and used to go around fingerprinting people all over the house. I thought that would be amusing. But then I realised that perhaps I wasn't cut out for that physically. I might not fade into the background. But my big love had always been movies and theatre. And the more that I went to the theatre, the more I decided I wanted to be an actress. And by the time I was about 9, I'd really thought that that was the number one.
Which is not surprising, because your father was in show business, wasn't he? I mean, he was a theatrical agent.
Yes, my whole family was in show business. My daddy was an agent, and his mother was a dancer at the turn of the century with a group called the Three Cape Girls. They used to do the can-can around the capes in South Africa. And my two aunts were also dancers with Jack Buchanan and his young ladies. So I was brought up in that sort of theatrical atmosphere. But it was more variety than legit.
This was in London you
yes.
lived.
Mm-hmm.
What was your mother's role in all of this? Was she glamorous and glitzy?
Mummy was very beautiful and loved clothes and loved very nice, pretty things. But she wasn't glitzy. She was glamorous, and she was very much of a mother. She wasn't interested in anything at all other than her husband and her three children and running her home as well as she possibly could. And she was a very good role model in some ways. Of course, I didn't follow it.
Yes, I gather, I read that she was very good at ironing.
Well, she didn't like it very much, but she was good at everything she did in terms of being a homemaker. Wonderful.
What sort of little girl were you then, surrounded by all of this? Were you very spoilt by all these theatrical folk who came by?
I spent a great deal of time, and I think that's where my gypsy existence comes from, being evacuated from as far back as I can remember to various places like Devon and Ilfracombe and Chichester, Bognor, Brighton. So I don't really think I was spoiled, as any children were in that age. We weren't spoiled. We didn't have sweets. We hardly ever had any fruit. We were lucky to have sugar in milk. So I grew up eating everything on my plate, which I still do. The constant battle of the bulge.
We'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. Shall we have another record?
Yes. Talking about those years during the war, there's one particular record that epitomises that, and that is, of course, Vera Lynn singing We'll Meet Again, and that reminds me of my baby and childhood.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Vera Lynn singing We'll Meet Again. You were very much your father's girl then, Joan, were you?
Well, I think so. There was that thing that little girls have in Anglo-Saxon countries of always trying to get the love of the father, and the father being the rather distant, aloof, strict, patriarchal figure.
You even, at one point, did you not try to be a boy, try to be for him the son he'd never had?
Yes, they wanted a son very much. There was me and then there was Jackie, and Dad used to love to go to football games, Arsenal being his particular favourite. And so I used to go along to these games at the age of 11 or 12, and sort of wrapped in a scarf, waving a ratchet, freezing cold, bored to tears, but thinking that he would really approve of me for doing that. But
and did he?
I don't really think so. I think shortly after that my brother was born, and so everything changed.
Could you ever please him, though? Did he ever turn around at any point in your life and say, you know, you're really clever, you're really pretty, I think you're terrific?
He wasn't that sort of a man. He was one of those men that are just very, not cold necessarily, but not loving and emotional, and it was always considered just not the done thing to give people compliments. It was the same with most of my friends. But we didn't, in those days, and I still don't do it, I don't sit around analysing and getting terribly analytical about my life. I find that a very American thing that I've never really been able to do. I just sort of get on with it.
People inevitably do it for you, though, don't they? I mean, the pop psychologists would say that that's what you'd been looking for in your husbands ever since, that you'd been looking for this father figure who would be warm where your father had been cold.
Oh, yes, but pop psychology has got an answer to every single one of the problems. I think that one of the things that it probably did do was having the complete antithesis of the feminist movement, which was my mother, under my father's thumb. I didn't see myself settling down and being like Mummy, much as I admired her and loved her. I just really didn't see the thrill in shopping and cooking and cleaning the house and looking after three brats, which was me and my brothers and sisters.
So you went off to drama school, to RADA, the mm-hmm. Royal Academy, and you'd go out in the evenings to jazz clubs and have fun. What did you look like then?
I tried a lot to look like somebody called Juliet Greco, who was the very dark, very long black hair and a long fringe. So I copied that. I had a very long fringe, so you couldn't see my eyes, and which were covered in black eyebrow pencil all around them. And I wore black polo neck sweaters and black stockings and black ballet shoes and big skirts or very short, tight skirts. Tons of bracelets. Nothing strange, really. Huge gold earrings. And a sort of sultry look. And I used to go down to 100 Oxford Street and dance to Humphrey Littleton, and George Melly would sing, and play Elvis Presley records.
And did you discover you were deeply desirable to men?
That's about when it hit me, yes.
We better have a bit of Elvis now.
He's done so many wonderful things, but I think that the wonder of you is something that brings tears to my eyes. And whenever I hear it, I always think it's such a tragedy what happened to him and can happen to too many people who take their fame too seriously.
Your kiss to me is worth a fortune. Your love for me is everything. I guess I'll never know the reason why.
Elvis Presley and the wonder of you. You decided quite early on in life, Joan, that you were going to be financially independent, didn't you? That no man was going to rule your life.
Yes.
Have you stuck to that?
Oh, God, yes. Absolutely. I think it would have been wonderful to have been able to have married somebody who was able to be on an equal footing financially. But unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Very early on, you were spotted, weren't you, by a photographer who was looking for an innocent young face, and he chose you.
Well, yes. I think they were looking for, yes, a sort of innocent young face. It was for a beauty queen film called Lady Godiva Rides Again.
What did the people at RADA think about all of this, all of your extramural activities on magazine covers and in films? Did they?
They were not happy. They got so fed up with me going off to film tests and my odd days filming, and they said I had to make a choice. And by this time I'd been offered I Believe in You, for which I'd had to test three or four times, and it was the sort of part of the year. It was a young wayward girl, a good time girl, as they were called then, and I was I just turned 17, and I asked if I could take 12 weeks off of the filming at Ealing, and they said no, you've got to decide now. I'd only been at RADA for a year. So I made the decision, and the decision was to leave RADA and go and pursue this film career. I went and did various films for various people, and I always play this bad girl role.
The good time girl.
Yes.
And then Hollywood sent for the good time girl.
It certainly did. That was quite a red letter day, I must say, because it wasn't really Hollywood. First of all, it was Howard Hawks, who was doing this film called Land of the Pharaohs in Rome. It was an American film. And they had cast a girl for the wicked Princess Nellifer. But apparently stardom had gone instantly to her head, and she started going around telling Howard Hawks and Jack Hawkins what to do. And she thought that she was the second coming of Grace Kelly. And so she was fired immediately. And they called me, who they'd seen in a few British films, and off I went winging my way to Rome, which was divine in those days. It was the height of La Dolce Vita. And there were thousands of American stars over there and thousands of American co-productions. And I did this film, and then 20th Century Fox saw it and bought me from the Rank organization, which is quite amusing. Like sort of pound of Brussels sprouts, I was bought.
Shall we have another record there?
Yes. Well, at that particular time, I was absolutely mad about Frank Sinatra. And when I got on my first pack for that first incredibly long flight to Los Angeles, which did take a long time because you had to change in New York, I played all the time in my room when I was getting ready, Come Fly With Me.
Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day.
Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Frank Sinatra and Come Fly With Me. Tell me about your early days in Hollywood. Were they completely dazzling?
I have to admit that going to Hollywood at that particular time, it was the last days of the time of true glamour, of wonderful restaurants, of amazing nightclubs, of glorious premieres, of a time when the press still had a certain amount of respect for stars and celebrities. And so consequently, stars and celebrities went out, dressed up, had a wonderful time. I met, within the first sort of week I was there, I met Gene Kelly, Judy Garland, Humphrey Bogart, Frank Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe. They were all around. Mm. For example, there were wonderful nightclubs like Ciro's and the Macombo and the Coconut Grove, and people used to go there and they used to dress up. And you'd see Gary Cooper, whom I met, and you'd see Meryl Oberon. And these people looked just as good as they did on the screen. Errol Flynn. I mean, I really met everyone. And, of course, I was I was terribly young. I mean, I was just 20. And it was quite astonishing. I used to just sit with my mouth open in awe.
You acted, in fact, with Bette Davis, didn't you, mm-hmm. in The Virgin Queen? She mm-hmm. was Elizabeth I. How did you get on with her?
Well, Miss Davis is not a great admirer of young, attractive actresses, I have to admit. She was quite intimidating. This was the second time that she played Elizabeth I, and she'd shaved her head. Which I thought was wonderfully daring of her. She'd shaved it back about 5 inches so that she could wear these red wigs. And she's quite an ogre, I have to admit, Miss Davis is. But she's one of those people who came from a school of hard knocks. She always had to fight. But I think it probably didn't make her as nice a person as she should be.
You didn't take too kindly to Bing Crosby either, did you?
Well, he's not nearly as nice as Bob Hope. Bob Hope is adorable and sweet and funny and the crew love him, but you know, you can always tell about an actor or an actress by the crew. And far be it from me to speak ill of the dead, but the crew did not like Bing Crosby when we did The Road to Hong Kong together, and they all loved Bob Hope, and I agreed with them. I just think that some people care about other people and some people don't, and the crew can certainly very, very shortly tell who is nice and who isn't.
So would the crew on Dynasty know that you care?
You'd have to ask them.
You acquired something else in Hollywood that was de rigueur at the time, which was a shrink, an analyst.
Mm.
Why did you do that? Did you do that because it was fashionable or because you needed one?
Well, I was going out with this man, and two of his best friends, and who became mine, were Marlon Brando, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. That's actually three. And they all went to shrinks, and all of their friends went to shrinks. And so all of us lesser mortals suddenly realized that shrinks were it. Besides which, he told me that I'd save so much money by going to a shrink rather than spending my afternoons at Saks and Magnans buying frocks. So I thought, well, why not go to a shrink? Let's see what that's all about. So I went, and it was quite interesting, actually. Since I'm not an analytical person, I never had been, I did find out quite a bit about myself.
Do you still have one?
No, no.
Given all that up?
Yes.
Don't need it?
I don't think so. I went to a marriage counsellor at one time when I was married to Ron, because I really didn't want to. I didn't want to have another failure. But it just really prolongs the agony. Instead of making the decision, you think about all the ins and outs and children and all of those things. And we eventually did split up.
Shall we have another record?
Yes. I would like to hear something from Puccini. And this particular piece of music from Manon Lescaut is, I think, so incredibly beautiful and so romantic and so stirring that I just play it over and over and over again, and I would do on my desert island.
The intermezzo from Puccini's Manon Lescaut, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Giuseppe Sinopoli. You mentioned there, Joan, your third husband, Ron Cass. You've written since about a period when you were married to him in the early 70s and you just had your third baby, Katie. You've described them as almost perfect years.
Yes, that is true. I think that I had reached a time in my life when I had done the career. I had become the big-time Hollywood starlet. I mean, I don't really consider that I was ever really a star, but I was quite well-known and had acted opposite some of the most illustrious people in Hollywood. And I had decided that by that time that although I liked being a star, it wasn't the be-all and end-all of my life, and I really wanted to concentrate on having my children, bringing them up, and doing the odd jobbing bit of acting if it came along. So we lived in the house in Highgate, and Tara and Sasha were at the local school, and Katie was sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I really couldn't have cared less whether I was a star or not. It was only when, for various reasons, we had to leave England and go to America in 1975 that I became less happy.
But was that, would you describe those years as perhaps the nearest to a state of happiness that you've come?
I think the last year of my life has been the happiest because I have come much more to terms with who I am and what I am. And I have a freedom that I haven't had before in my whole life. And I'm doing very much what I want to do.
And there is no husband?
No.
You've been married four times, and you've been very frank over the years about your love life. Do you ever wish you hadn't been quite so honest? Do you ever wish you'd been a bit more private?
Well, I have to say, Sue, that I actually haven't been that honest in really. I mean, maybe I have. I am a sort of honest person. I don't. I mean, yes, I was married. Yes, some of them were mistakes. But and a lot of people say, oh, Joan Collins has had this tragic love life. In actual fact, I haven't. I've had a wonderful life with all of the men that I was married to and have been involved with. For the time that we were together, it's been absolutely terrific. And I am of the opinion that if you're with somebody and it's not working, if it's not bringing you happiness, that you should get out. Because life's short and life is very sweet, and it's not going to be too sweet if you're saddled with some man who makes you sick.
And you don't like the idea that people think, well, Joan Collins has been incredibly successful professionally, but she's really had a bit of a disastrous personal life.
Oh, no, I don't, because I don't think I have. I don't regret, certainly I don't regret my two marriages that brought me my three children, not in the slightest, but I think my first one, I was far too young, and I won't mention the last one.
Is marriage now definitely O-U-T? Is that it?
No, I never say anything definitely. I think, obviously, since I've done it four times, it's obviously something that I quite like. But, I mean, it doesn't have to be marriage. Living with somebody would be fine.
Shall we have your sixth record?
Yes. I'm a great fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber. I think that he is, in terms of Britain, the best sort of composer, writer that we have. And I love The Phantom of the Opera. I went to see it about five times, and I love All I Ask of You.
Ask of You from The Phantom of the Opera, sung by Steve Barton and Sarah Brightman. We were talking, Joan, about Alexis Carrington earlier on. She was, after all, a great turning point in your career. Mm. Did you know the minute you got your first whiff of her that this was the one for you?
Well, I knew that I could probably make something of this role, although I only saw the first script and I'd never heard of Dynasty. Because it had been on for 13 episodes in America and it hadn't come here.
And it wasn't doing very well either.
No, it wasn't. But I had been watching Dallas previously, and I had thought to myself, and I told my agent, I really would quite like to be in one of those soaps. I think I could probably do something with one of those roles. So when it came along, I thought that it was a part that should be played with a certain tongue-in-cheek, rather grand, glamorous, woman-of-the-world quality. And they brought me, first of all, these funny little suits. And I said, no, I'm not going to wear those. I said, I want furs, I want gloves, I want hats and veils. And it created a bit of a fashion statement.
Absolutely. She was very stylish. The greatest problem, I suppose, she brought you is that everyone has since assumed that you are like her. You are venal, ruthless, calculating, immoral.
I know. Of course, it is very difficult when you've been associated with a role to get away from that image, and that's why what I want to do is I want to get away from that and do more comedy, because I think I'm quite good at it.
I was going to say, isn't the answer to do comedy? I mean, we all remember you in those Cinsano adverts with Leonard Ross, and as you say, you played Alexis with your tongue in your cheek. I mean, there's a comedian in you, isn't there?
I think so. I did one comedy film with Paul Newman called Rally Around the Flag Boys, which I loved doing, and I do see the funny side of life a lot. It is, of course, daunting because I do get sent a lot of scripts which are Alexis clones. And I'm not saying that, oh, God, Alexis is so terrible, I want to forget it. I don't. It's been terribly good for me, and I enjoyed doing it tremendously. And if they say to me, do you want to come back and do, you know, the odd episode, which, of course, they are, who's to say that I might not do it?
So although it's been left as a cliffhanger, you might just return.
I might. But not on a permanent basis.
Shall we have some more music?
Yes. Let's have an aria by Puccini, which is O Mio Bambino Caro. I'd like to hear Kiri Takanawa singing it.
Bambino Caro by Puccini, sung by Kiri Takanawa, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by John Pritchard. It does sometimes seem, Joan, that everyone is waiting for something awful to happen to you, for your bosoms to sag or your eyes to bag or something. I suppose it's part of your fascination, but does that annoy you?
It doesn't really annoy me because I'm not the only one that they're doing that. I mean, Elizabeth Taylor gets it more than I do.
But it's always women. I think my point really is that they wouldn't do that to Paul Newman or to Telly Savalas. It seems very unfair.
I don't know. I think they do. I think they're starting to do it to people. It's as though getting older is some kind of a crime in this country, and unfortunately also in America. But I do think that people do have a wisdom that they get as they get older. And there's no question but that people in their 40s have got far more wisdom and knowledge than people in their 20s, and I think that should be appreciated.
And they should be proud of themselves.
Exactly.
Is that why you hit the centrefold of Playboy at the age of 50, because you were proud?
Yes, I think that I did that because what I was saying was, OK, perhaps not every woman of that age could do that, but I was saying that it is not only a girl of 23 who can look good. I think there's far too much emphasis on the physical today. By the same token, it was a sort of statement, in a way, was saying to women, look, maybe you can't look exactly like this, but you should be able to know that you can look pretty good.
We were talking at the beginning about your having wanted to be a boy at one point for all those various reasons. It does seem, reading about you, that you have, if you like, approached your life in quite a masculine way, this determination to be financially independent. You've pursued men and dropped them. You've earned the money. You've called the shots. You've taken the knocks. You've kept the show on the road. Is that how you see it?
Well, not exactly, because it's been a gradual thing, really. I mean, I remember being told when I came into the business at the age of 16, actually, that I better do what I could, because by the time I was 23, I'd be washed up. And I remember thinking that I just thought that was so unfair and wrong, and that it wasn't going to happen to me. So it's just coming to terms with the fact that life isn't easy, but you bloody well make the best of what cards you've got and play them as well as you can.
You said at the end of your autobiography, which you finished 12 years ago, you said, "It's taken me a long time to grow up, but I think I'm almost there." Are you now, do you think, a grown-up?
I think I am, actually, Sue. I feel that I am, although I think I still have a rather childlike side, which I probably won't ever lose, because I have this sort of enthusiasm for life, and I don't ever want to lose it. I like my life, I like who I am and what I do, and I'm quite at peace with myself.
Shall we have your last record?
Yes. I love Lionel Richie, and I think this rather epitomises perhaps a certain side of me. Love will conquer all.
Lionel Richie singing Love Will Conquer All. Much gyrating going on in here. So as you stretch out on your desert island, Joan, and wait for the knight on his shining white yacht to come and rescue you, which of those records are you going to have to play more than any of the others?
Well, I think I would play the intermezzo from Puccini's Manolesco, because I think it's the most romantic and the one that I could hear more than any of the others.
The most durable.
Yes.
What about a book? Because we give you, already there, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Well, that should take me a few years. I think if I can have the complete works of Shakespeare, then I'd like to have the collected works of Oscar Wilde.
You're not really allowed collected. Well, you really ought to choose one bit of him.
Well, if I can't have the collected works of Oscar Wilde, then I'll have the picture of Dorian Gray by
right.
Oscar Wilde.
You shall have it. And a luxury.
Well, my luxury would be some kind of all-purpose suntan oil moisturiser, because if I didn't have that, I would probably turn into a prune very rapidly, since I'm not a strong believer in lots of direct sunlight on the face. So I would take an extremely large bottle of moisturising lotion.
And preserve the face. And preserve the body.
And the body, yes. And you could also cook with it at a pinch.
Shh, don't tell me that. Joan Collins, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Islanders.
Thank you, Sue. It was great. I loved it.